now we are recording.
So, first of all, could you just say your name and your various hats?
Yeah, my name's Patrick Grant. I'm the Pro Vice Chancellor for Research at Oxford University. I'm also the Vesuvius Professor of Materials in the Department of Materials here in the University.
Lovely, thank you. So first of all, can you just tell me a little about yourself, starting from when you first got interested in scientific research?
Yeah, I trained at a bachelor level as a materials engineer.
Where was that?
That was at Nottingham University.
Mm-hmm.
And much to my surprise, discovered I enjoyed research, and then decided I should follow that and do a PhD, and was offered a place here in Oxford in the materials department, and did that. And I have stayed here ever since, and been fortunate to progress my career through different levels of independent fellowships, then a lecturer, a reader, a professor, and then in 2018 I became Pro Vice Chancellor for Research.
And what would you say, if you had to define a sort of single question that gets you out of bed in the morning, what would it be?
I think as an engineer, we are interested in understanding how things work and making them work better. And I think that has been very true of myself. I particularly are drawn to problems in the manufacturing industries about how we can create more sustainable, better performing products, particularly in the areas at the moment. I do a lot of work in the area of batteries and trying to make a better battery, which I think we all feel we need.
Yes, absolutely. And what are the main scientific approaches that you take to studying that question?
Yeah, I suppose we often have ideas that we need to test. We diagnose a system or a material or a manufacturing process where we think there are some limitations or things could be done better. So in order to make things better, we normally need to unpick how they work right now. So my methodology often involves, as well as doing the experiments, we do some simulations which help us check whether our intuitions about the way that the underlying physics is working in a process. There are often lots of things happening at once and how they interact and what's important. And then as a material scientist, I'm interested in how the heat and the mass flows go to contrive the final structure of the material, and the structure then controls its performance. And if we can unpick that, we have a chance of contriving conditions that make the material better.
Excellent. Well, that actually leads me quite neatly to asking what made you want to step into an academic leadership role, but it immediately makes me think that you're dealing with human engineering in a way, aren't you?
I think there is a part of that I have wondered whether that is part of the engineering drive, which is a desire to sort of or to fiddle, to, you know, almost irresistible desire to try and make things function a bit better. I mean, I don't think there's any nobility in that. I think it's just the way engineers tend to feel and the things that they get drawn to. I think engineering is actually quite a creative process. It requires the imagination, and it requires people in order to deliver on that imagination. And so I've always worked in groups and teams, and really enjoyed that sort of traditional concept of a research group, both when I was junior and then now I'm leading a group myself. I really enjoy that environment, and perhaps taking that away from the laboratory and into the administrative area felt like a natural step for me. And I've been very fortunate that I've never had to choose. I've always been able to do both. So even now, as I'm Pro Vice Chancellor, I still have a research group of 20 people.
Hmm. And how do you split your time between
two? As you might imagine, it's difficult. I actually, in contract, I have a 80% PVC role and a 20% research role. Probably does work out something like that, but it's not as simple as saying just a day a week on research.
No, it adds up to more than 40 hours a week.
Well, it does add up to more than 40 hours a week.
Yes.
But they're all problems of my own making, and I think I'm just slightly hanging on with my fingernails. I'm negotiating doing both jobs at once.
So, shifting to COVID specifically, can you remember, just at a personal level, first of all, where you were when you first heard about it, or how you first heard about it?
Yeah, I think I almost certainly heard about it first on the radio news. Of course, like everyone else, I had no sense that of where it would lead. But certainly, I think in the late January and early February, I can't be precise, but it feels like it was becoming a more common news story, eventually a daily news story, and then started to hear things within the university grapevine as well, about people in medical sciences becoming quite interested in what was going on.
And how soon did you realise that actually this was going to have a major impact on the university in a variety of ways?
Yes, well, of course, the first wave hit us a bit later than elsewhere. So by the time it really did affect the university, I think we knew it was going to.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't come as a complete. There was a dawning realisation that there was no way that we were going to miss this, and what we were seeing in mainland Europe and in China, for me, it was a slow realization that it was going to hit us too, and that it would, I don't think really thought through what that means, but it became increasingly clear that a lockdown of sorts was going to be needed. And you know, I think that happened all the way through February, and then it was really just a matter of time when the government would press the button.
Well, I see the impact as in your area as falling in two ways. There was the predicament of huge numbers of research staff who weren't going to be able to go to work.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, there was the opportunity to actually address the problem from all kinds of angles.
Yes.
and put the university's research expertise behind that. So if we could just take the first one first, we'll go through that and then go through the other.
Mm.
So, I mean, first of all, the university had to make some kind of collective response, and presumably that was a discussion that you were part of.
I think in retrospect, it felt like at the time, it felt like a huge burden, and it felt like a very, very uncertain time, and not really knowing what the future would hold, and it really was very destabilizing feeling. But actually, in retrospect, those decisions were easy because they were actually rather clear. The government said we need to have a lockdown. We weren't going to do anything other than what the government told us to do. So in a sense, the actual decision to effectively shut most of the university was actually quite easy. I mean, there were some mechanics about how to do it in operational terms, which was all quite difficult, and I think in such a big organisation with a high degree of devolved responsibility, at times a bit chaotic because people were doing their own thing.
Can you give an example?
In the way that the university is configured with its divisions and then below divisions the departments have a very high degree of autonomy under our constitution, and that serves us well many times. But you know, we would find out that departments had already sent their staff home, where we were. What was emerging then as the university's crisis management team, you know, we were thinking, shall we send people home? Should we wait another day? You know, and then we'd hear, oh, such and such a department has already sent their people home, and it was just completely uncharted waters. And we all ended up at the same place, which was more or less a shutdown of the whole university. But actually, doing that in an orderly way was quite a challenge for us. Yeah, but I think we got there in the end. I think when it, as we'll get on to later, when it came to reopening, it's not so black and white. They were much harder decisions, because you're now degreeing and you're now trying to agree sort of the extent of how far you go in any direction. And, you know, the stakes feel quite high with people's health and at stake. What was also quite helpful, I think, though, was that the guidance that we got from the government made it very clear that the what we call the lockdown in teaching and research did not apply to COVID research, and of course that again sort of seems quite obvious, but was totally critical for us, because, you know, we had people who were doing really important work. But it also, funnily enough, provided, I think, in some ways, both an allowance and an incentive to allow people who were not working in that area, didn't see themselves as working in medical sciences, working on medical problems, would turn their hand to that research and then therefore qualify under that guidance to keep going. And I saw that, I think for some people that was a bit of an incentive. Mm. You know, so we had people, you know, building their ventilators. Of course, that work was encouraged to continue. And so although we had the very obvious groups in infectious diseases work and vaccines, you know, working away harder than ever, redoubling and then redoubling again their efforts, we also had a whole constituency of researchers who'd never worked in that area being at work, whereas everyone else wasn't.
And yes, so you mentioned a crisis management team.
Yes.
You were part of that.
Yes.
Yes, yes. And how often did you meet?
Oh, sometimes we were meeting formally, I'd say. There may have been a time when we were meeting 3 days a week. And there was lots of informal sort of discussions going on pretty much all the time. So then there was quite an extended period where we were meeting twice a week. And then it has gone back down to once a week, and there was a period when it was probably once every 3 weeks, but didn't last as long as we'd hoped. And at the moment, we're back to every 2 weeks.
Mm. But things, absolutely basic things like people getting paid, was that all taken care of under the government furlough scheme? Did you?
Yes. So. Well, of course, there was uncertain, you know, there was a strong feeling that how can the sort of the finances of the university continue in quite the same way, and we did set aside fairly early on some money from our reserves as a contingency. Our major concern was that. Because the lockdown was sort of running through March, April, May, we pretty much wrote off much sort of additional economic activity, if you like, during that academic year. But what was really worrying was, what will the next academic year hold, the one that was due to start in October? And so we made, you know, I think we did three scenarios, you know, that we were still shut, that we were open to some extent, or that we were fully open, and that's why we needed we created the contingency, because it was looking extremely bleak, particularly in terms of overseas students being able to come here, either whether they could come legally or whether they just didn't feel like they wanted to come would have a big impact. But also during that process, because we did make that contingency available, we made a commitment that we wouldn't make people redundant because of COVID explicitly, because of the pandemic, at least for I can't quite remember, but I think for, you know, a pretty extended period, we said that, you know, we took some remedial actions. You know, we had a recruitment freeze and other expenditure freezes, promotions and discretionary pay awards were all frozen, which of course people were unhappy, well, no one can be happy with that, but I think they understood job security was worth a lot when everyone was feeling so destabilized because we'd never been through this before. So to have a, you know, a pretty good guarantee that your job is going to be safe unless things really went to some another step, a step worse, was, I think, you know, we were very fortunate as an institution to have the financial strength to be able to do that. So everybody did get paid, and we did make some very limited use of furlough. The colleges, it's not really my area, but you know, the colleges made use of furlough. There were some posts in the university, but mainly we kept on paying our core staff as we would normally, and then our research staff, which is what I'm particularly focused on, is a lot of them are actually paid for from external grants, and I have to say that our funders really stood behind us, and I think behind the sector, and didn't start cancelling contracts, didn't say if that researcher is sitting at home we're not going to pay them anymore. I think we had a fantastic response, people, because they were going through it themselves, and they would, you know, they wouldn't want someone to do it to them. And so, you know, and maybe there were a few examples where for no fault of their own, you know, companies got in really real difficulty and couldn't settle their quarterly invoices for a while. But I have to say, by and large, our external funders really stood behind their commitments.
And did they get any refunds from the government? It's not a question I've ever thought of.
Well, the government did make some more money for you know, many of our researchers are funded essentially by the government, and the government did make extra money available to prolong people's contracts to compensate them for the time they'd lost in their research. But more importantly, they didn't stop paying,
so they
allowed people to be at home and to be working from home, which is another story, of course. And our biggest other funder is the Wellcome Trust. They stood totally behind their commitments too. There were a few smaller, well, not that small, but smaller than Wellcome Trust charities who rely on you know, fun runs, high street shops, that's where all their money comes from. Those were all closed.
Mm.
Those are all stopped.
Mm.
So they just couldn't carry on with the same level of of commitments.
Like Cancer Research UK and the Sharp Foundation.
Exactly. Yeah. And we, you know, you can't do anything but completely understand that. They're doing what they have to do. But I have to say, I don't know what it was like across the sector. Here, through the generosity, through people being understanding, we pretty much managed to keep everybody more or less on the post that they were contracted to. I think we did a good job.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Just from a little bit of reading I've done online, I get the impression that some of these, that particularly the research staff, did have a number of problems. I mean, things like, even if they could work, they might be having to homeschool their kids.
Yes.
And that kind of
thing. Yes, absolutely.
So what kind of systems did you set up to support them through all that?
Well, I think that they would probably say not enough.
Mm.
And probably that's true. So yes, people were asked to stay away, or they had to stay away in the first lockdown. And I think initially, you know, most people, even if they were experimentalists, had enough to do looking at data. You know, researchers typically always have research papers which are half written or research grant proposals. And there was, of course, the shift to online meetings through various well-known packages now that we all got used to, have all got used to using. And I think, you know, for 3 or 4 months, it was okay. People probably had enough to do. There was perhaps a certain amount of inventing new things to do, or changing your research from being entirely practical to do, you know, more theory, more analysis, more reading, finish off that literature review you said you were going to do. But I think by the time we got to sort of 4 or 5 months, people were sort of running out of genuine tasks to do. working from home, and of course I think the lockdown was, you know, beginning to get a little bit relaxed then, which came just about at the right time. Meanwhile, of course, those people working on COVID were working harder than ever,
mm-hmm.
But everybody else was having to find substitute tasks to do. And then the labs started to open, and the libraries and the other research facilities, and people could come back. But it was a highly regulated environment that they were coming back to. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, social distancing very, very strictly enforced, the capacity of buildings way, way down.
But you did a survey in about July, was it, of what the staff were thinking?
We did do it. We did do a survey, and the homeschooling impact was clearly one of the biggest impacts, which I can 100% relate to. We did make some funds available for people to help rebuild their research momentum.
Yeah, I would think so, yeah.
Which, you know, we couldn't do it for absolutely everybody, but we did it for the most obvious cases. You know, there was informally, you know, there was a lot of people, you know, coming in and grabbing their computers and taking them home in their cars and, you know, their chairs and you know, it wasn't like we suddenly made a whole load of laptops available for everybody and proper chairs. It was all quite ad hoc. And personally, in the beginning, it was sort of slightly exciting in a way. You know, it was so novel, but the novelty very quickly wore off. And I think people did find it very, very difficult juggling poor IT performance, trying to look after their kids, trying to look after themselves, you know, trying to take advantage of the limited opportunities there were to go out and take exercise and things like that. It was tough for people.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't just suddenly find everything that everybody was asking for, but I think we did prioritise, particularly at the departmental level, rather than from the centre, departments did very practical things on the basis of need to help the most affected people.
Mm-hmm. But one of the things that seems to have emerged from that is that a need to have some kind of two-way channel of communication with the research staff,
mm-hmm.
that possibly hadn't existed in a way that might have been helpful even previously.
Well, I think there's always... I think people are very, 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 very different in how they approach what they want from their research and how research is managed. So you get, you know, very big research groups which are very sociable, and sort of have a sort of a subculture of their own. And then, of course, you have the lone scholar who is quite used to working on their own and everything in between. The thing that really concerned me was, we have people arriving from overseas to take up research jobs here who, you know, would turn up and pretty much go instantaneously into working from home, quarantine, and then working from home. And you are trying to then sort of induct them into those cultures to make them feel welcome, to show them how the university works and to get them going on their research. And that was really, really hard, I felt. And some of those people had families too, and again, going into quarantine and lockdown. The way people were supervised, I mean, personally, it made me sort of formalize supervision a bit more than perhaps I might have done in the past. So because I couldn't actually meet anybody...
This is in your own research
group. In my own research group, you know, you had to sort of diary everything into your online meeting. Whereas in normal times, I would kind of go into the lab and say, who needs to have a word with me? You know, I'll see you at 11, I'll see you at 12, whatever. Because you couldn't do that, you actually had to formalise, and it actually made me able to track who I was seeing and who I wasn't seeing, and better than in normal times, which I would sort of just keep in my head. But I do think that overall, researchers reported more a greater sense of isolation and a missing of that buzz. That even as a lone researcher, you still can get going into the library and being in, you know, it's a nice environment in Oxford. But if you're just in your bedsit, you're just really missing that buzz and that sort of being part of this great research enterprise feeling that you get just being in and around the university.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is one of the things that we're still trying to rebuild to get right back to the pre-pandemic levels, that fizz and buzz of what it is to be doing research here.
So what was the role of the research staff hub that you set up?
Well, this is again a slight benefit of the pandemic in that I was required, but also wanted to find ways the universities could do more for our, particularly for our fixed-term contractor research community. So these are people on external research grants who are paid to undertake relatively specified bits of work, normally under the supervision of a senior academic. And we have over 5,000 people on fixed-term contracts. So they're our biggest staff group. There's this churn all the time, and they're the real engine house of the university's research excellence. But I think we all recognise that we could do more to make these people feel welcome and to offer them more diverse opportunities in the university. Because unlike undergraduates or postgraduates, they're not part of a college. They tend to be much more departmentally based. And we haven't in the past really sort of looked after them from a careers point of view in the same way that we do our undergraduates. So I just sort of thought we need to hear from them. We need to work out what we can reasonably expect to do better for that community. I think one of the first things we did was to make sure that community had a proper representational structure, so people's voices could be heard, and to be able to divert or direct those voices into the right forum. So getting one thing, you know, quite early on we were able to do was to get representatives of the researcher community onto university council and all the major committees of the university. So that was something quite easy to do to begin with. But then we realised that there were some other things that we could do centrally to complement what departments were doing locally with their subject-specific expertise. But there were some things that needed to be done at the centre, not least to ensure some commonality of approach. And that's really how the hub came about. Wanted to create a small team of people who would work with departments and divisions to coordinate what we were doing for our fixed-term contract researchers in a more coordinated way. And also, we signed a national concordat for what's called a researcher staff development, which again really commits the university to investing a bit more into its research staff by making sure they have time to pursue their own projects, making sure we take career development seriously, that we look at the research culture or research cultures that are in the university to try and make sure that this is a great place to do research. And ultimately, I'd like, you know, people in that position in their career to say, I want to go and work at Oxford because I hear they really look after their people. I don't think we're there yet, but the hub is part of that, part of that journey, and appointing some people into a role where they're exclusively there to help fixed term contract researchers with their careers, I think sends a great signal that we're serious. We were actually putting some money into it, more and more, I hope, and yeah, we'll see how far we can go. But I'm quite ambitious for the hub.
But that's a very big piece of work to have done during the pandemic. So would it have happened without the pandemic?
I think we had enough momentum and enough willpower, and I think the zeitgeist was in the university that everybody could see, you know, that to be a good modern employer, we need to invest a bit more in this area. I mean, one of the things that slowed it down is we have a physical building for the hub, and we couldn't get into that building to finish its development. On the other hand, it meant that we did everything online, including the launch. And actually, online is quite a good way to promote inclusion. We've learned that. In fact, we have had some events since where people said, you should have done this online, not in Burton. You'd have got more people along. It would have been more inclusive. And you know, we're a small town, but nonetheless, it takes a long time to move around. So if you want to involve people from medical sciences up on the Headington campus in a lunchtime hub event, that's a two-hour commitment in person, but it can be 45 minutes or an hour online. So I think it allowed us to get more voices and more people involved in building up the hub idea, working out what it was going to work on first and to get it launched.
Brilliant. Okay, so let's move on to COVID itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I've talked to quite a lot of them already, but obviously a lot of people decided very early on that they were going to pivot their research to focus on COVID. Was there anything you needed to do to facilitate that switch?
Oh, I wish I could say I'd had a hand on the tiller, but great researchers, they don't need to be told what to do.
Mm.
I think at best I played, or the Central University played a facilitating role, and I think we did do that. No, it was just inspiring. I mean, I felt guilty I wasn't doing more with my own material science research, seeing the way how imaginative some people were. I mean, the thing that I think gave me a great sense of satisfaction and was great for the university was the way our donors also spontaneously would ring up and say, "How can we help?"
Mm-hmm.
And this was even in the very early days of us working on vaccines, when it wasn't clear at all that we were going to have anything to take outside from the university. Even before then, people were really wanted to help, and so I set up a committee to look at how we could disperse these donor funds, because donors would say, I don't want all the whining and the dining. I just want to give you some money now and feel very confident that you'll spend it wisely on something that's going to stop this pandemic or make a difference as soon as possible. And that's a real challenge for us. You know, we work on 3 to 5 year funding cycles. We write grant proposals. We have them assessed. We get a letter telling us we're going to get the money, and 6 months later we start the work. You know, we had donors who were saying, you know, we want to help right now. And of course, we have people who wanted to do something right now. But in terms of the systems we operate, they're not systems designed to be that agile. So as I was saying, one of the things I did do is that, with fantastic support from the administration who are handling all of this, I pulled together a group of people when we created a really short form to people to fill in. It said, if you've got an idea that can make a difference in the short term to the progress of the pandemic, we want to hear from you and tell us what you need. And we would have these marathon meetings that would last sort of four or five hours, where we'd get all these ideas the night before, we'd read them through, and then we'd debate them the next day. And at the end of that day, we would disperse the money, and sometimes we were spending £5 or £6 million per meeting.
So this was the COVID-19 Research Response Fund.
Yes,
because there was was there an earlier thing called the Strategic Research Fund? Was that?
Oh, I'll come to that in a second.
Okay,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. So this was the COVID Rapid Research Fund, people were very collegiate. These were fast decisions, so you know they were probably only 80% right, but they were really focused on getting resources into people's hands who had ideas, so they wouldn't be tied up chasing money, and they could do something. And there were other mechanisms that would fund them in the medium and the longer term. But that was a tremendously a good experience, and I think everybody felt good who took part, because you felt you were doing something.
Mm.
Instead of just responding, you were actually doing something. So that was great. The Strategic Research Fund was a little bit earlier, just a little bit earlier in the story, which is that I think the team, the vaccine team in the Jenner, felt pretty confident pretty quickly that they were going to have a vaccine that would make it through animal trials and should go into human safety and efficacy trials. They think there's quite a lot of confidence that they would get at least that far. But that would require a certain amount of vaccine, the one that they had developed and were interested in understanding more about. We need a certain amount of vaccine to be available for trials, and beyond what we could make within the university, we have a small manufacturing facility, which was really critical in the very, very early days. And they needed something like £1 million to place a contract, I think, in Italy for manufacture, not knowing that it was ever going to work. But if it worked, then it would be available. And their existing grants didn't have that capability to do that. They were applying for money but hadn't heard back. And so we had a discussion to say, there's £1 million needed, and I think everybody around the table said, let's just do it. I think the detail of it is that there is a fund which I chair called the Strategic Research Fund, where if that £1 million had ever actually been needed, that's where it would have come from. But in the end, it was not needed, because by then other grants had come through. But being able to underwrite that level of cost, that liability at that point, to stop people worrying about it so they could worry about more important things, again, was something really, really good that the university could do. You know, we're fortunate that we had those resources. I'd only just set the Strategic Research Fund up actually a few months before then. I'm sure we would have found a way if we hadn't had the Strategic Research Fund. I don't think it was that critical, but it was very nice for me, having argued that we need to be able to invest strategically in our research, that one of the very first things we did was underpin the vaccine, should it have been needed.
Mm-hmm. So what can you give me some idea of the range, some of the range of things that you funded through the Rapid Response Fund?
Yes, I'll try to remember sort of the diversity. I mean, I remember we funded a program that looked at the psychological effects on intensive care unit doctors and nurses, which turned out to be really, really important. Of course, there are lots of studies still going on, I believe, still going on in that area, and it shows that even very, very early on in the pandemic, there was an awareness that, you know, this, you know, is very traumatic for the medical staff involved. So even though we were in that first peak of hospitalizations, it was clear that it would be very valuable to have some work of that type. Of course, we funded all the real hardcore vaccine stuff that you might imagine, but we also funded some sort of alternative therapies, so not just vaccines, but, you know, antibody treatments and things like that. We did quite a lot of funding of diagnostics, so, you know, things that look quite like lateral flow tests, and in fact, you know, some of the things that we funded have gone on to have quite strong commercial possibilities of their own. And of course, we also helped fund some therapies as well. There were lots of ideas about what might be a useful therapy. So no, it was very empowering to actually be able to feel like one was doing something, and it's all due to the generosity of our funders who would literally take the reassurance of a phone call to say we'll spend, don't worry, we'll spend this on something that's really focused on the problem.
Mm. So they came to you initially. Did you actually put out a call?
No.
You never put out a call?
No, I mean, I wouldn't say we put out a call. I mean, we talk to funders all the time, and at that time there was only one topic of conversation. So we didn't ever sort of have to have a separate targeted campaign. Many of the people who gave us money were people who had already given us money and began to hear what we were doing with the vaccine, but also with the therapeutics, the recovery trial, and some of the other contributions we were making to ventilators, to track and trace. I think we had quite a high profile in the news.
Certainly.
Our press office, was busier than it has ever been. The vaccine drove a lot of that, but it wasn't just the vaccine. We were doing a lot of advising as well, in lots of different spheres, in government and beyond, around the world. So our profile was really high, and that definitely helped donors pick up the phone to us and say, how can we help?
Hmm. So, to what extent, if any extent, did you communicate with administrators at other universities?
Yes. So, me personally, a bit. I mean, there is a regular meeting of other Pro Vice Chancellors for Research amongst the research intensive universities, and within that, then you always sort of tend to have people who you've known for a while, who, as well as the formal meetings, you just pick up the phone to and say, what are you doing about return to on-site working? Probably the most I did that was with Cambridge, just because it's another collegiate university. It's another university with a disaggregated devolved responsibility structure, so it's just easier to compare notes with that type of organisation. Cambridge were very, very generous and helpful with some of the things they shared with me, which definitely helped us make wise decisions, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let's just pick up return to on-site working, because you mentioned that earlier and I didn't follow up at the time.
Mm.
Did that present a new set of problems?
Yeah. Yes, I think that was amongst the most difficult, because you would literally in a day have a communication from someone saying, what are you doing? You're destroying my career. I need to get into my lab and do my work. I can go to a football match, or I can go to a restaurant or the cinema, but you won't let me back in my own building. What on earth are you doing? And then the next email will be from someone saying, what on earth is the university doing opening up its buildings? Don't you know there's a public health crisis going on? Just look at the hospitals, look at the local hospital, you're just going to create more cases. Just trying as a group, I think all of the big decisions were made as a group, but just trying to sort of navigate what is the right level of opening up, how should we word, how strong should the encouragement be, how mandated should it be, how much latitude should we give individual departments to apply the rules, it was all completely unknown. I mean, most of us were not medics, although we had fantastic regular advice from our own medics as well as government advice. But just getting the degree and the tone right, week by week was challenging.
And it's waxed and waned and fluctuated.
It goes up and down, and you take your lead from the government, but you have to interpret that for the university, and you have got these different communities. You've got the undergraduate community based in colleges, not in the central university, but often accessing central facilities, who operate on these short, intense bursts of study in the terms. and you've got the graduate community, which are here for more of the time, and then the fixed term contract researchers and all the administrative staff. You know, the way that the government intention, what the government said you could and couldn't do, was slightly different. You know, you had Department for Education giving some type of advice that was apparently consistent with the broader advice, but actually often didn't seem to be, and didn't come out on the same day, and often a very different time. So just sort of trying to do the right thing, support the staff, do something which is credible, but the last thing you want to do is to do something that you feel is contributing to people becoming ill.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, closing the university is not helping anybody's research career or other career, and a lot of people, you know, need to get out from where they're stuck and want to come back to work, and you need to facilitate that. So just finding the middle way. I think in the end, we didn't do a bad job. We didn't do that differently to other universities, I think, you know, but smart people often come to the same answer. But it did feel difficult, and it felt loaded, particularly in the early days, until we got more used to it.
Mm-hmm. And do you think things have settled out at a kind of new equilibrium where working from home is accepted as something that people might do from time to time, or is the goal still to go back to exactly how we were?
No,
before?
I think it's neither. I think the goal is not to go back to how it was. I think we have to recognise that we've learned that digital working, for some people, for some of the time, is absolutely fine. It's a more civilised way of doing things. It's more efficient of their time. It's better of their work-life balance, and it's more productive for the university. So we definitely don't want to go back to where we were. And personally, I don't think we should go back to where we were. But neither do I think we've got the new equilibrium. I think there is a new equilibrium to be had, but we're not at it. So I think we're still working through the ramifications of what many people have been working from. What that means for the university, I don't think has quite landed, and it may well be very difficult, very different for those different communities, undergraduates, graduates, support staff, academic staff, researchers. I think if you're an experimentalist, probably the new equilibrium looks very much like the old equilibrium. If you're working in administrative support, you may find that actually the best thing for you and for your productivity and for the university is to work at home 2 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, like every other major employer, we're on that journey to working out how to work out who fits into which category, what's best for them, what's best for the university, and what the implications are.
Mm-hmm. Several people I've spoken to have said what a revelation it's been, that what they've been doing has been much more collaborative. I mean, obviously people collaborate in their groups, but there's been tremendous collaboration across groups and teams, not just in the medical sciences, but in, for example, in social sciences.
Yeah.
And some people have just said how wonderful they found that.
Yeah.
In contrast to the usual kind of academic cut and thrust, is that something that you've been aware of as well?
Yes. I mean, I have to say I'm really pleased to hear that, because one thing that I do think has been missed, a little bit like the buzz and the fizz I said of the research environment, is those in the corridor, in the street, in the canteen meetings where you get talking to people or you bump into somebody and it spurs a thought. It that sort of serendipitous way that research works, and the way particularly people earlier in their careers build their research networks by chatting to people and trying things. And it has worried me that building of networks and the exploitation of networks has been really quite badly impaired by working from home. The digital environment doesn't so readily offer those kind of happenstance events. So it's good to hear that from what you said, that some people have nonetheless managed to find new connections, new networks, and new
And new
studios.
I think it's about making something that's thought to be for the public good, rather than just to advance your own career. So not just, again,
yes,
not just the vaccine, but things like some of these big data systems that people have set up in the Blavatnik School, for example, and
yeah,
the things they've done there, and the Our World in Data and all that kind of thing, which are there for the world to use.
Oh, that's such a great example. Yes.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a really good example, and accelerated probably our understanding of how digital tools can help what we might call open research or open science,
yes, yes.
Which is not just, you know, publishing your papers, your learned research papers, but actually getting people involved in research, showing them as it goes along, being part of the research. I think because we've been stuck at home a bit more, probably, you know, getting to grips with those digital tools has been hastened.
So I'm coming back. My last few questions are much more about your personal reaction to the pandemic. So, to what extent did you ever feel personally threatened by the possibility of catching it?
I don't think especially, because I think, yeah, I was very, very fortunate that I could hunker down in my home with my family and function. In most of my job, obviously my research was hit like everyone else's, in a way that actually felt quite safe. You know, I wasn't compelled by my job to be the first person back on public transport, or, you know, on the crowded tube in London. I can walk to work or take the bike, and, you know, I have a nice environment at work. Unfortunately, I have a large amount of space, so I didn't feel in practical terms. I mean, you know, existentially you do feel it when you turn on the news and you see these terrible statistics, and you sort of think, well, you know, there's no reason why I shouldn't get it compared to anybody else. But I think I was able to contrive a fairly safe personal environment, luckily.
And what about your working hours? I mean, you're obviously you said at the beginning that because you've got these two hats, you're very busy anyway. Did you work much longer hours than normal?
I mean, obviously the job I hold, there's a lot to do, and I choose to work long hours in order to sort of feel like I'm on top of the job. I think at times they got a bit longer, but I was also in the main part of the pandemic at home, like everyone else, with three children and my partner, and that creates a certain sort of tempo and heartbeat in the house where I don't think it's really easy or right to sort of shut away and do 10 hours. We're all in it together. I worked, you know, as hard as I normally worked, I think, and maybe on occasion a little bit harder. But I had plenty of distractions, which is a good thing.
I'm sort of assuming that you haven't been involved in teaching since you started in the
I haven't, no. Not tutorials or lecturing.
Yeah, so we don't need to talk about teaching. Were you involved in the COVID safety regime, either for this building or for your lab?
Yes, I was, yeah. So I mean, I was part of the sort of distributed group that developed the return to on-site working protocols, social distancing, ventilation, one-way circulation, checking that the buildings, when we brought them back to life, didn't have Legionella in the water systems. And, you know, so I was involved, certainly not the lead in the detail, but certainly involved in all of that. And then was on the receiving end of my own advice, because then as a group leader with research laboratories, we then had to put those in place. Putting the yellow stickers down on the corridor floor, thinking about how many people can go in each room at a time, and what's the safe number of people to have in the building, and how to get people to and from the workplace safely. Yeah, so as a
And do you think that worked well in general?
Yes, I do. I do. And I think in general, across the university, it worked well. I mean, I don't know whether it's still true, but we, I think for the at least the first 18 months, we really did think that we couldn't find any evidence of workplace transmission of COVID. So although there was COVID in the university, it was happening in social settings. I think within our buildings, there was no transmission. In fact, you know, people have some people have said we were too conservative. We could have actually been a little bit more ambitious for how many people we had. But you know, I think it's a great record.
And you more or less answered this earlier, but did you feel that because you had a job to do that was directly related to making things better for people, did that support your own well-being?
That's an interesting question.
I didn't phrase it very well. I've done it better in the past because I'm asking everybody this question.
I think my well-being was okay during through both sort of my, you know, professional and privately. And you know, I was just very, very fortunate because you know my family wasn't struck down in any tragic way. Knew lots of people with it who'd caught it, and you know had a reasonable environment for us all to be locked down together. In fact, my children are an age where normally they would have left home. So my wife and I feel we had you know, an extra 18 months with them before they've now gone off to get on with the next part of their lives. And yeah, I think from a well-being point of view, did okay. You know, better than some for sure.
And do you think? Oh no, I did that one. So would you say that the experience of the pandemic has changed your thinking about your area of responsibility? Has it given you ideas about how to manage research across the institution that might apply equally well in non-pandemic times?
The big learning, I think, has been how fast we can do things when we really have to.
So the university reputation is for moving a bit slowly.
it is, and I think sometimes we actually believe that a little bit too much because it's such a comfortable cliche. You look at all the old buildings and the tradition, and it's easy to sort of then fall into the trap, say that we don't move with the times and things happen slowly, and of course there are examples of that, but you know we've done a lot in the last few years, even before the pandemic. And you know, sometimes I wish we, instead of having just postcards of all the old buildings, we had postcards of all the fantastic labs and all the great inventions and companies and things that we actually have done here too. So, but the pandemic has shown us we really can be agile and we can do things fast. And you know, my job was not really, I don't think, to invent those things, but to challenge myself about how fast we could do things. So what I'd like to capture for the future is that sense of we really can do things quickly. It's exciting to do things quickly. People can can spontaneously change research fields and throw themselves into something, and we need to find out how we can support them doing that. I mean, the most obvious thing is, you know, there is a climate crisis. Could we, I know many people are already, but could we go even further in really pivoting our research with the sort of urgency that we did around the vaccine into the climate crisis? You know, I need to think how the Central University can do that. I guess not overthink it, otherwise it'll be too slow. But yeah, just try to that sense that universities can make a real difference. You know, look at the vaccine. It we've all felt proud in being part of it, even if we've had nothing to do with it personally, just to be part of the same institution. You know, how can we capitalize on that great feeling to really inspire people to do even more in their research? So that's what I hope is a permanent change that I've expressed there, and I hope, you know, I can get as many other people to feel the same way.
That's lovely. Mm. Thank you very much. Mm.